Our panelists are Dr. Randy Doyle. He's stepping in at the last minute. We really thank you for being here. Sandy McDonald at the last second could not make it. So Dr. Doyle is Deputy Director for Research at NOAA's Earth System Research Lab here in Boulder. We have Dr. James O'Brien. He is the Robert O. Lawrence Distinguished Professor of Meteorology and Oceanography at Florida State University. We have Dr. Peter Tans, Senior Scientist at NOAA's Earth System Research Lab here in Boulder. Dr. Kevin Trenberth, Senior Scientist and Head of NCAR's Climate Analysis Section. And Dr. Warren Washington, Senior Scientist and Head of the Climate Change Research Section in NCAR's Climate and Global Dynamics Division. And as some of you may recall, he is a past president of the AMS. I believe you served your term in 1994, if memory serves me correct. So what I'd like to do is ask each panelist, we can just start with Dr. Doyle and just work this way, to quickly tell you their area of specialty. And what I'd also like each panelist to do is, if there is one area of climate change they feel is most misunderstood by people, to perhaps maybe expound on that and maybe shed a little light on that, or maybe clear the air on that particular thing that they think is most misunderstood. So we'll start with Dr. Doyle and work our way down.
Okay, my primary area of specialty is linking weather and climate. My background actually started essentially as a synoptic dynamic meteorologist. And so I have gradually moved out from weather to the to climate change, most recently serving as part of the U.S. delegation for the Climate Change Science Program Synthesis and Assessment, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change meeting that was held in Paris, in which the IPCC Working Group 1 report was accepted. In terms of what conception or I think is most important to understand, first, the term global climate change, there are profound regional variations in climate change, and those have very important impacts on public perceptions. If it doesn't change in a particular region, or if it changes, seems to change in the opposite sense to the general sense of warming, you will frequently get asked the question, I don't see climate changing in my backyard, therefore global climate might not change. I think I would add to that, just as is, climate change is not spatially homogeneous, it's not temporally so as well. That is to say, it's completely expected that we get pauses, that we may get transient coolings, particularly as we go down to regional and local scales. That doesn't in any way negate the fundamental conclusions that have been derived from a great deal of research over the years. So I think you can explain to your public both, yes, we expect that parts of the country will be different in the responses to change, and also that any transient, a temporary cooling, even an extreme cold season may not be indicative that this hypothesis is then negated. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. I've been engaged in climate modeling for over 40 years now. I want to say something about climate modeling. It's based upon basically all of the physics that we understand operates in the climate system. So in the early days on the climate models were very crude, we had very poor resolution, our computers were very limited so that we couldn't go into sort of detail about many aspects of the climate system. Well, as the science has evolved and we've understood better about sort of things like evaporation from the oceans, vegetation, clouds, various aspects of the climate system, and we've incorporated all of those new findings into our climate models. And we actually verify our models very severely. We first of all try to understand on the present climate and actually try to understand on the changes from winter to summer, because there are very significant changes, and to a certain extent you can sort of test our models in that way. In other words, if we go through on the seasonal cycle, I think that's a pretty good indicator if we get all of the basic regional climate features such as the monsoons and the precipitation changes and so forth. And then we also test our models in trying to understand past climates. Since we certainly have a lot of data about the climates of the ice ages, for example, or the Cretaceous when the alligators were up at the North Pole, and so we can understand on these things by using model sort of simulations. Now, one of the misunderstandings, I think, is how we sort of do future projections of the climate. And we typically run our models out to the year 2100 or 2200. And there is a lot of uncertainty about how, for example, greenhouse gases are going to change in the future, or if the aerosols in the atmosphere are going to change, or even if there's changes in the forcing of the sun. The forcing of the sun isn't constant. It does vary, so we can put those features into our models and make projections into the future. But they're based upon certain assumptions. For example, how we sort of deal with greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide. So all of these things are put into our models, and we sort of make the projections into the future. And what we offer to the policymakers and the public is a range of uncertainty, as well as a range of the certainty that we feel confident about. And I think Kevin Trainberth has been a very active player here on the IPCC, and he would be explaining on that process.
Okay, Peter.
I've been working on this issue since 1972. I was still a student. I saw a little book in a bookstore. It's called Inadvertent Climate Modification. I was curious. I was also very skeptical that this could possibly be the case. How could we little human beings change the climate on the Earth? But I leafed through it. I was sufficiently intrigued that I bought it. I read it from cover to cover. Everything actually that we now talk about was already in there. Greenhouse gases, aerosols, land use, etc. Now, what I work on myself is I observe greenhouse gases. And we study their trends, and we try to quantify sources and sinks. Where do they come from, and how are they destroyed? And I want to leave you with one quick thing, that a note that is not widely realized. Mankind has been emitting greenhouse gases, especially CO2, since the middle of the 19th century. And 50% of all the emissions of fossil fuel generated CO2 have taken place since 1983. Half of all emissions since 1983. 75% of all emissions since 1961. We're seeing just the beginning of it, of climate change. The other quick note about greenhouse gases I want to leave you with is, on a timescale of human civilization, CO2 remains in the atmosphere-ocean system forever. It takes thousands of years for the CO2 that we have emitted to disappear by natural means from the atmosphere and ocean system. Thanks.
Kevin?
Well, compared with most climate scientists, I have a fairly unique background. I come from New Zealand, and I was actually a weather forecaster in New Zealand for a few years before I went to MIT to do my PhD. If you think forecasting is tough here, you should try it in the middle of on a small island in the middle of the Southern Ocean where there's no observations around in times before they had satellite soundings. We did. That was at the beginning of satellite imagery. It was interesting. My own research is focused much more on energy and water cycles, where the energy comes into the system and how it flows through the entire atmosphere, ocean, ice system, and how that changes over time, how the energy gets stored and released and moved around. And so that does relate to climate change. And also the water cycle. Where does all the water come from with in any storm that we have, for instance, and the runoff and the stream flow and the river discharge and the changes in salinity in the ocean and things like that. As Warren mentioned, I've been heavily involved in the IPCC. I was a coordinating lead author of Chapter 3 in the last report. So that's the main chapter that deals with observations. And so the main statement out of that report is that global warming is unequivocal. That means without doubt, any doubt whatsoever. And it's really built upon the compelling evidence from multiple variables, not just atmospheric temperatures, but also sea level and melting ice and various other things that are going on. And I'd be happy to amplify on that. But there's one aspect of things perhaps I would like to say to you, which relates to the question we were asked to pose and address. And you know, we're often asked these days as to whether a weather event is caused by global warming or whether it's natural variability. And it's not a well-posed question. In fact, these days, it's always both. It's always both, Jim. there is a global warming component to all of the weather events. And so how that works is that with global warming, the main reservoir for the heat is the oceans. And so since 1970, which is sort of when global climate change from humans has really emerged above the noise of natural variability, there's been about a 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in the global temperatures of the oceans. Going along with that, there's a 4% increase in water vapor in the atmosphere. This is the column integrated water vapor. And it's true over the global oceans. Over land, the increase is more like 2.5 to 3%. And of course, over deserts, where it's water limited, there's almost no increase. And so over land, it depends on your access to water as to how large that increase is. And it relates to the increased water holding capacity of the atmosphere. As you warm up the atmosphere, it can hold more water vapor, and it does. And so we've got good observations that water vapor is increasing in the atmosphere. Over the oceans, it mainly comes from microwave instruments that are showing clear increases. And so what happens? If you have a weather system of any kind, whether it's a thunderstorm or whether it's an extratropical cyclone, and it's developing in an environment where there's more water vapor lurking around in the atmosphere, it rains on average 40 times harder than it does than any evaporation. Evaporation goes on all the time over the entire world. But when it rains, it's concentrated. And it's only raining about over 1/16th of the globe at any time. That number depends on your threshold. But if there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, what that means is that these systems are reaching out that factor of 16 or so, which means in terms of linear dimensions, a radius of 4 times the area or the linear dimension of the rainfall to grab the available water vapor simply to supply enough moisture to produce the rainfall rates that we observe. You know, the average evaporation rates are 3 millimeters per day. We can easily get rainfalls of an inch in a day. And so the water vapor has to be gathered in by the storm. And of course, that's what the winds do. So there's a storm scale circulation that reaches out, grabs the available water vapor, concentrates it, and dumps it down in the form of precipitation. And so if there's more water vapor in the atmosphere, it rains harder. And we've seen some classic examples of that along the Mississippi this year. And so instead of having a 500-year flood, we have a 50-year flood. And it's getting less as time goes on. And so the main thing that happens in association with this is that when it rains harder. Or when it snows, it can snow harder because there's more moisture in the atmosphere. And so a key supplier is the Gulf of Mexico. That supplies also hurricanes. In hurricanes, there's good evidence also that precipitation is increasing. And that can contribute to the intensity of these storms as well. There are many other examples around the world. You know, at the moment, the heat waves in California are associated with wildfires, drought in the southeast of parts of the United States last year. There's many changes that are going on, and even more dramatic in other parts of the world. So my message to you is that global warming is coming, ready or not.
Jim?
Hi, I'm Jim O'Brien. I'm a recently retired professor at Florida State, but I'm flunking retirement. here I am. In my early career, I was an ocean modeler, and I stumbled onto the concept of El Nino in the late 70s and helped explain the physics of it. And then after the 82-83 El Nino, my group and two others were asked to see if you could forecast it, and we showed there was some capability. And then in the 80s, people from all over the world looked at the impacts of ENSO, as it's called, El Nino Southern Oscillation. I helped say there has to be an opposite side, which we now call La Nina. And then after 1990, although routine studies of changes in the United States were done, people weren't looking at the vast, wonderful data we have from our observational system of weather over the United States. And so I had my students work on things. And so now I'm known as, you know, when the press wants to talk about El Nino and hurricanes, or El Nino and tornadoes, or where you should have your snow vacation, and a dozen other areas that we have done the work. Because of that, then right after, in the mid-90s, I switched from my ocean and climate work to doing giving agricultural people in the Southeast short-term climate forecasts. I'm one of the leaders in the Southeast Climate Consortium, which has the people from Miami, Florida, Florida State, Georgia, Auburn, University of Alabama, Huntsville, and we recently expanded into the Carolinas. And we provide short-term climate forecasts, that the government finds impossible to do. Certain thing. Well, Kevin, it's like this. In Central Florida, there's lots of shallow ponds. And what they want to know is, what's the probability that you're going to have 3 days in a row that it's around freezing? If it freezes at night and goes back to 50 during the day, they don't have no problem. The problem is, it stays around 30, the shallow pond gets cold, they lose their whole crop. Okay, now you go find me a government person who's going to work out that data. You can go on our website. It's called agclimate.org, and see the kind of information we're providing in the Southeast. I took up as a state climatologist in the mid-90s, and since I retired, I turned it over to somebody else. As a state climatologist, we provide interpretation of what happened to anybody that wants to know in terms of, and wonderful things. I'd like to relate just one incident to show you the kind of things that we can do. We had great forest fires last spring, a year ago, in Georgia, and they flipped over the Georgia line. So, and the winds were from the east, and so all the way to Tallahassee. In the morning, before the inversion broke up, visibility was less than a mile. The young man driving toward Monticello, which is east of Tallahassee, and couldn't see at all. He ran off the road and hit a tree, got a ticket for careless driving. The policeman didn't even note that he couldn't see. Okay, and so his mother came to us, and even though you cannot go to the weather service and say, what was the visibility at 9 o'clock in the morning on such and such a day near that place, she got anecdotal evidence, which was presented by the mom to the judge, and the young man got off. That's what we kind of call climate services, okay? That's an example of climate service. Oh, I'll give you another one. It's at the swamp. Some of you don't know what the swamp is. That's the Florida football stadium. At the swamp, they were very concerned because University of Florida wanted to have their turkey games in August in the afternoon so they get television revenue. The manager of the stadium wanted to know what was going to be the heat index. And we told him what the heat index was. He actually took health precautions to provide, you know, extra water, cheap water, tents and things like that for people because he knew that hundreds of people were going to have problems with heat. Now, what's the big question here was asked today was, what do I think is the biggest misunderstood problem? And it has to do with sea level rise. I do believe in global warming. I believe in global climate change. I have huge global climate change, which I might be able to tell you about in Florida and the Southeast. But sea level rise is happening. It's been happening for a long time. A lot of it is crustal rebound, and some of it is from melting stories. The sea level network of tide gauges estimates the current rate, which is not accelerating, at around 12 inches in 100 years. Kevin quoted correctly in one of his recent articles I read from the satellites. We have these marvelous satellites called altimeters, which were not designed for sea level rise, but they can measure sea level rise because they're measuring the shape of the ocean everywhere, and they're estimating between 15 to 16 inches in 100 years. And the good news is that the latest one was just launched last Friday successfully. It's called TOPEX. Mm-hmm. So at least on that observation from the United States, we're going to have continuing evidence on it. Now, what's the problem here? The problem is that I've met older folks from the Jersey Shore, the Carolina Shore, and the Florida Shore who believe Al Gore, that he's going to get 20 feet of sea level rise before they die. Okay? And I've seen scientists after scientists and pseudoscientists and NGO people show the famous picture where a third of Florida goes away with 20 feet of sea level rise. And for the broadcast meteorologist, when you have someone tell you about sea level rise, and they're going to tell you that, you know, Florida's going to have, you know, 20 feet of sea level rise, you ask those people when. Okay? And there's no question that with global warming that sea level is going to continue to rise. Okay? And it's a very slow time concept. But just for a fun thing, you know, one of the things that Al Gore says is that, of course, that very quickly is going, something's, I don't understand, called a tipping point, and Greenland is, all the ice in Greenland is going to pop into the ocean and melt and really cause a big rise, okay? And so I like to ask people like my colleague to the left of me, do you know what's going to happen with sea level rise if all of Greenland water melts? The sea level around Greenland is actually going to fall by meters very slowly because the land's going to come out of the ocean. But I think that sea level rise has been used as a scare tactic and not being explained properly to the public. Do you realize that when El Nino, La Nina occurs in the Pacific, let's say off the coast of Ecuador, that's plus or minus a meter, over a meter of sea level rise and fall, plus or minus a meter as the ocean sloshes back and forth and changes all the weather over our country? I mean, so the West Coast of the United States experiences lots of this and a lot of other. In Sweden right now, sea level's falling dramatically. So I think that someone down here, Warren, was you just said about the local, oh, Randy said about local thing. We have to really look locally. And I think the next effort in our science on global climate change is going to be to try to understand and educate people more on what's happening locally. That's enough for now.
All right. Well, thank you. Now, I think what we'll do, we have just under an hour for your questions. We have a very distinguished panel here, as you've heard. What I'd like to do is go to a model that we used a number of years ago at these conferences and maybe have you line up, if you have a question, at the microphone here, and we will get to those questions, as many of them as we can. We ask, obviously, to be as thorough as you can, but also to be as brief as you can so we can get in as many questions. And while we're waiting for people to come up with some things that they want to ask, I have one very brief question, and that is that I think a lot of people believe that there is a split, like an even split, in the scientific community supporting or opposed to the IPCC conclusions. And just from all of my interaction with climate scientists, including some of you over the years, it's my impression that there really isn't so much a split, but rather there's an overwhelming majority that is in favor or at least supports in principle the IPCC process and conclusions. Can you at least tell me what the degree of division there is in the scientific community on the IPCC conclusions and process?
Well, as the main person here who's been heavily involved in IPCC, maybe I should comment on that. Let me briefly make a few remarks about the IPCC process itself. You know, the IPCC was set up in 1988 out of the First World Climate Conference by the United Nations under the United Nations Environment Program and WMO, the World Meteorological Organization. And it was designed to carry out major assessments of the climate and how it's changing, and in particular the role of humans. And so there's been major assessments in 1990, 1995, 2001, and now in 2007. There are three different working groups. The first one, which I've been involved in, is the science of climate change and the modeling and the projections. And the second working group deals with the impacts and adaptation and vulnerability to climate change. And the third working group deals with options for mitigating climate change. How do you slow down increases in carbon dioxide and related things? The IPCC process is very open. There are a lot of authors from around the world who have now all shared in the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Let me give you some numbers. In the 2007 assessment, there were over 450 authors, lead authors, and 70% of those were entirely new. They had not been involved in previous ones. There were 800 contributing authors, and there were over 2,500 reviewers from over 130 countries. In my chapter, we had 10 lead authors, 66 contributing authors, and about 100 pages of text, 126 figures, and 863 references. There were two major reviews carried out, and in our chapter we received a total of 3,500 comments on it into the two reviews, the 2,230 in the expert review and 1,270 in the official governmental review. And all of those are responded to in a major big Excel spreadsheet. Every comment is responded to as to how it was dealt with and addressed, or the report was changed. And then finally, the policymaker's summary was approved in Paris. Randy was there on representing the U.S. government in part at a meeting with 113 governments. And there, every word is debated. And so this word, unequivocal, was approved by 113 governments. And that's a remarkable achievement. And so the experience that I've had is that if people are informed about climate change and they look at the information, then there is a strong agreement, and there's also strong support for the IPCC process. It's a very open process. The scientists who speak up are often perhaps not climate scientists. They're not in the field, and they're perhaps not as well informed. And from what I saw in the report just before the break, maybe some of them are in this room here. And so I urge you to look at the information, because here we're dealing with facts and science, not just opinions.
I'd like to add one thing to that.
Okay, go ahead, Peter, and then we'll take the next question.
Yeah, the summary for policymakers is a very carefully phrased document and also very conservatively phrased. So if you read that, it is a distillation of the entire report, but in a very conservative way.
That's true. Okay, Richard, go ahead.
I hope I don't ramble or... I'm not so concerned about what's already happened, but I'm wondering about the uncertainties in the projection of future climates. And I'm particularly concerned about the representation of the synoptic climatology. And I noticed that some of the seasonal models, for example, have a hard time depicting the blocking, the degree of blocking that occurs in the Pacific Basin. And I noticed that Dr. Robert Hart at Florida State noted that the tropical cyclones aren't represented explicitly, and he said that the climate models responded by strengthening the trade winds to maintain the global balance of heat and momentum. I'm wondering if the difficulties with the representation of these synoptic features perhaps make you worry that the range of uncertainties that are being projected are maybe too optimistic. Are the uncertainties possibly wider than what is being given? And the second part of my question is, with these regional difficulties, does that make the prospect of regional climate change projections even more difficult?
I'd like to take that one. I also participated in getting part of the Nobel Prize, for the audience to know. As a person who is very concerned about short-term climate variability for my users in the hydrology and agriculture and water in the Southeast, I'm very concerned about the regional thing. And I will tell you right now, I told you that I worked long and hard for many years with my students on trying to understand El Nino, and Fortunately, the climate scientists doing the models realize now, but the biggest variability of climate over the United States is El Nino, La Nina. Over not all the United States, but lots in the Northwest and in the Southwest and the Southeast, and it's not properly represented. A lot of the models either have no El Nino, permanent El Nino, or El Nino every 2 years. But the good news is that it's now recognized that we'd have to fix that up. Also, for people in Europe, there's something called the North Atlantic Oscillation, and I recently heard a thing where they were looking at the models from the point of view of that, and they get the phase of the North Atlantic Oscillation, you know, completely wrong. So we have a huge amount of work to do on the models in terms of at least getting, you talked about blocking, you talked about hurricanes, I talked about the ENSO effect, these other oceanic phenomena. Much more attention needs to be paid to the ocean in these models in the future. I think the scientists are going to work on it, will do it. But and these are probably not the things we want to tell the public, right? Are they smart enough to know all that?
You deal with the Southeast. You should know that answer.
Warren, did you want to say something? It looked like you
were
trying
to... Well, I just wanted to say that on the point that was raised about the synoptic features, I do think we have a ways to go in our models to improve those features. And what limits us to improving a lot of the regional features is resolution. It isn't the complete answer, because we still have to get the clouds right and the coastal environments right. But I see hope coming as we're getting faster and faster computers, and we can increase on the resolution, and we can capture things like on the blocking events and the sort of realistic storm systems in the mid-latitudes, as well as we're right on the edge of incorporating in our global models in a realistic way hurricanes and typhoons. So I think I can see in the future that these features will make our climate models more realistic. Having said that, I don't think that the major conclusions coming out of the climate models are going to change tremendously by the fact that we don't have as much resolution as we would like.
You want to add something, Randy?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think you've asked an excellent, one of the outstanding questions that we really have, and looking from a research community perspective. Certain patterns are beginning to emerge, certain large-scale regional structures, for example, a tendency towards drying in the subtropics. Now, does that mean that we're definitely headed towards a drier climate in the southwestern U.S. and attendant impacts? We're not quite there yet, but I would say that one of the aspects that must be clearly conveyed in all the projections is that they are the probabilistic in nature, that they will have distributions, there will be uncertainties. That will always be the case. But as Warren says, as we move forward, I think we will be able to define more specifically some of the regional variations, the storm track shifts, which are projected now dominantly to move poleward. For example, blocking is a pervasive problem in these models. They don't get that right. And then what Jim said, I think, is also very crucial to getting at the regional patterns of climate change. We need to get the oceans right, and it's not clear at all that we've got that yet in the models.
Jim Gandy, Columbia, South Carolina. My question to you is, one of the arguments we've had at times has been the confidence level in the observations that are being made, and from that, the conclusions that are being made. So not only looking at just the temperature data, but looking at all the data that you have to look at in your climate models or whatever you're doing, how confident are you in the observations that are being made?
Well,
do you mean the model observations or the surface observations?
Surface
observations.
You know, observation. We don't have a climate adequate climate observing system
It's one of the things which I would like this community to help advocate for. What we have is a weather observing system, and as a result, expediency stations get moved around. They're not sited in places where the environment is stationary. People build buildings and roads next door, and we build cities around the place where we're making observations, and urban heat island effect ensues, and things like that. And there is a lot of care that is taken over a select set of observations called the HCN network in the US. And there is a tremendous amount of work that goes into trying to adjust the records for inhomogeneities. We shouldn't have to do that, in fact. There's a, you know, I have a lot of respect for the scientists that try to do that around the world. And so there are some imperfections. There was one that was just discovered recently because they have finally put all of the information from the logbooks from ships and made them available as to how observations of sea surface temperatures were being made. And in the early part of the 20th century, you threw a bucket over the side, hauled it up, stuck a thermometer in it, and measured the temperature. And then it depended on what happened to the bucket and how long it sat on the deck and various other kinds of things. And that switched during World War II to engine intake measurements. And so when you have an engine in the ship and the water is going in to cool the engine room and there's a thermometer inside the engine room, why not use that? But that's at a certain depth below the surface, and it depends on where it is in the engine room, how far it's close to the outlet or the inlet versus the heat from the engine room. And the transition of when that occurred is now being revised, and it was originally all put into the record as occurring in the mid-1940s, but now it's recognized that this is actually spread out over the whole of the 1940s and even into the 1950s. And so a bump that has been in the temperature record in the early 1940s is now being dispersed actually throughout that period of time. It doesn't alter the overall trends, but there are revisions of this nature that go on. It's the same thing with the satellite temperature record. It's undergone many revisions. We shouldn't have to do that. And so it's a challenge for us, but it's putting all of the evidence together and how it hangs together in a physically consistent way that makes the compelling case that the climate change is actually occurring.
I'd like to say something about another aspect of the observations. I can tell you with great confidence that the greenhouse observations are extremely accurate. They are very, very carefully calibrated. We're doing it by multiple methods, multiple laboratories with overlapping sites, and it allows us to conclude that the rises in greenhouse gases are 100% due to human activities, 100% plus or minus a few percent.
Randy.
Yeah. I think Kevin's very last point is a key one. I mean, first, every bit of observational data we can get, co-op observations, for example, may have limitations, but they certainly add to our knowledge of the record. But the conclusions and why the U.S. government and Saudi Arabia and other countries all came to the same conclusion that there was unequivocal evidence of warming was that the accumulated body of evidence that we go on, not just the direct observations themselves, but sea level rise, reduction in snow cover, a whole range of other observations that one can go down, even to phenological changes in the blooming dates for plants that have shifted to a longer season in response to the warming. All the bits and pieces of evidence led to that conclusion that it was unequivocal. I mean, Paul asked a really good question, just as lead and not responding at the time. You know, when the challenge that many of you have is to try to really present a balanced report, and often the structure of that is a kind of a he said, she said kind of report. Well, you know, one of my good friends and one of the most distinguished skeptics, has looked at I think now believes that warming is occurring. The debate has shifted to, is it, you know, going to have significant impacts and how big is it going to be and that sort of thing. But I should note that same individual is also skeptical about the links between tobacco smoking and lung cancer and continues to smoke. And so people have different levels of evidence that eventually they make decisions on, and he's perfectly fair. This is a free country. He can decide that the evidence is not compelling, that there's a link between lung cancer and smoking, or between some of the anthropogenic forcing that's so elegantly measured by Peter and his group, and climate change and the observations that Kevin has really led in the synthesis of. But the governments have kind of gone past this now. And I think many of you are probably aware that on Wednesday there was a confidential briefing, a National Intelligence Council. The security communities, defense communities, are past this now, and they're beginning to look to the future. And so I think that ought to be sort of a weight as you think about how this evidence is coming forward, and how it even very skeptical levels, and scientists by their nature are skeptics. Of eventually, and I will say I was one of them, Tom Carl, another distinguished scientist, Kerry Emanuel, another distinguished scientist, started out as kind of skeptics on this, Peter, mentioned. So, I mean, we didn't all start off, we were convinced by the evidence.
By the way, before we get to your question, Kelly, great question about the obs, because we took a bit of a climate hit in the 1990s when we switched from humans with eyes and rain gauges to ASOS. And, those ASOS units are controlled by the FAA, and they don't give a rat's you-know-what about climate. And so, that's part of the, we're getting improper rain gauge measurements in certain cases, certain situations now, and we only see clouds up to 12,000 feet. So, that was a part of the problem.
10 miles visibility.
Pardon me?
10 miles
visibility. And 10 miles visibility, that too. So, all right, Kelly.
I'm Kelly Beattie. I come at this from the astronomy perspective. One of the counter-arguments often raised is that the sun is actually increasing the warming. And as evidence, they point to possible global warming on Mars, and I heard Jupiter the other day. To what extent at all is the IPCC trying to drive this as a observational constraint, and what are you coming up with?
Well, the measurements of the sun going back in time, there's a lot of ground-based measurements which show sunspot cycles going back to the times of Galileo and so on. But the quantitative measurements from the ground are complicated by the presence of the atmosphere. And so it's only since 1979 where we've had instruments on satellites above the atmosphere that we've got a reliable record of the total solar irradiance, the energy that's coming into the planet. And it's remarkably constant after that time. There is an 11-year sunspot cycle, which has a magnitude of 0.1%. There are more sunspots, there are also more bright spots on the sun, and it turns out there's an increase in the output from the sun of a very small amount. That's not enough even to make a difference in our climate models. If it were sustained over a long period of time, such a difference of 0.1% would add up, and it would have some climate impact. But on an 11-year cycle, you're only just beginning to feel the effects, and it's less than a tenth of a degree, and you're gone back in the other direction. And so there is no evidence in the main period of warming that we have after 1970, which is, as we mentioned before, the main time when the human signal has emerged well above the level of natural variability for the sun causing this. There are then some other theories that have been put around that, well, maybe it's related to cosmic rays or just the ultraviolet part of it, and somehow it interacts with ozone and various other kinds of things. All of these are actually addressed in the IPCC report in Chapter 2, and if you're interested, I would refer you to that in more detail. Some of the empirical evidence that's been done relating changes in the sun to changes over time, especially to changes in temperature and changes in clouds, actually turn out to be based upon cloud data that are no longer valid. And so the original conclusions from those studies are actually not correct. So changes in the sun could indeed change the climate. And over time, going back in time to Galileo's time, may have contributed somewhat to the Little Ice Age. It's probably contributed changes in the sun. There was some brightening between about 1920 to 1940 that may have contributed to as much as a tenth of a degree Celsius warming is the best estimate at the moment, but not more than that.
Steve Newman from Dallas, Texas. The IPCC states that it's unequivocal that human global warming is in progress. We just heard you say that human activity, it's 100% the cause of the CO2 increases. We heard a colleague of yours yesterday say up in at NCAR that it is very likely that human activity are causing global warming. Is there a reluctance to say it's unequivocal that human activity is causing it?
The very likely says that it's 95% certain, well, actually 90% certain, but the sense of the scientists who were involved in forming that was that it's about 95% certain. The reason for a little bit of the uncertainty relates to things like changes in the ocean and the uncertainties in climate models. There's a very, very tiny chance that some of this could be mislabeled, but it's a very conservative statement in that regard.
Yeah, Randy, you want to add to that?
Yeah, there are really two problems here. The first is what's called detection of climate change, and there's unequivocal evidence of warming, that the climate system is warming, and that's the statement that comes out. The question that was really asked is, what's the attribution of that warming? And that gets back to the solar question. Could that account for it? And the IPCC, as Kevin says, showed that the effect is probably even smaller than was estimated in 2001 and is less than 10% of any signal that we're seeing from other sources. And the way an attribution is done is, first you have to detect that a change has occurred, and that's unequivocal. The second is that you have to show that you can simulate, model that response to your postulated forcing, and that's, in this case, including both natural forcings, volcanic, solar, and human influences from greenhouse gases, aerosols, and so on. And that's the second step. And that was done. And then the third part of it is, you actually have to show that it's inconsistent with other reasonable mechanisms. And so, in essence, what was done was a set of model simulations in which you either included or excluded greenhouse gases. And if you excluded the greenhouse gases, you could not simulate what has occurred over the 20th century and back in earlier times. So, whereas if you include them, you can simulate it. If you exclude them, you can't. But include all other natural forcing mechanisms. So that's the basis for the attribution statement. But we always have uncertainties on our models, and hence that multi-step process requires a little less certainty than simply the detection itself.
Yeah, Warren, you wanted to add something?
Well, yeah, I just wanted to add the point that if you're using climate models, you can use them in different ways, and one of them, as Randy has indicated, you can leave something out, or you can not change something, and then you can see on the effect. And so there are two records that we really observed very well. The one is in the 20th century on the globally average temperature has actually gone up. And the second one is the increase of carbon dioxide. And so we can actually run experiments where we leave out the increase of the carbon dioxide, and you see that the climate has not increased over the 20th century. If you include on the carbon dioxide increase, then you can approximate the 20th century temperature increase. And so I think this is almost like a smoking gun. It sort of identifies what is the major factor in explaining on the change of the climate during the 20th century.
I would like to add one thing to that. A problem that we have as scientists in quantifying and predicting climate change is that, sure, we see warming and we know that the greenhouse gases have gone up, which causes what we call positive forcing of climate change. We also know that there have been increases in aerosols. However, we cannot quantify very well the extent to which aerosols may have provided overall net cooling. we suspect that on average they do provide cooling. There's also aerosols that cause warming. So that's really, from a scientific perspective, that's a real pity, because it hampers us in our ability to predict longer-term climate change, because we cannot quantify the overall forcing that has happened. We have this one big wild card there that we can't put a good number on. If we had that, if we had a number, then we would have the forcing that has occurred since the mid-20th century. And then we can relate that to the response that we have already seen and have much more confidence in further predictions.
Joe Murgo from Altoona, Pennsylvania. I'm going back to that, and I'm not arguing about the carbon dioxide, 100% man-made, but asking questions, I think, is one of the best things that you can do. And one of the things that I haven't ever seen answered before, and I'm going to separate out what's going on right now for a second. Do you know, and I know it can be totally unrelated, but do we know the reasons, can we simulate why in the past we've had spikes up in carbon dioxide? Steep spikes, not as steep, not as much. I want to separate out the last one. But do we understand that yet? Can we simulate that? Because I do think that is an interesting question that is brought up that people don't know yet.
What part of the record are you referring to of peaks in greenhouse gases or carbon dioxide?
Carbon dioxide?
Yeah, because, see, you look at the last 10,000 years, and it has been remarkably flat. It's almost no variation.
I'm talking about graphs that you can go back
860,000
years and more.
Estimation. 800,000 years? Or,
yes.
Yeah.
If we have the answer to that, it would actually help understand. Do we know in the past why the Earth has had spikes before? And I'm not saying this is the same as last time, and I'm not saying those spikes were for the same reason in the past, but do we understand that yet? Do we have any answer to that?
Well, the main sources of that relate to the warming of the planet. So if you look at the Antarctic ice core record going back 650,000 years now, we have these synchronous changes, more or less, in temperature going into glacials and interglacials. You know, the last major glacial was 20,000 years ago. And going along with that, there are changes in carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere. And so I assume that's the main thing that you're referring to.
Yes.
And so when the oceans warm up, they cannot hold as much carbon dioxide. There's a certain amount of outgassing that occurs. So that's, if you warm up the oceans, then there is a release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That's one component of it. Another one relates to soil carbons in particular, and this relates to especially bogs and permafrost and some of the things we saw a little bit earlier this morning in the presentation that I think Paul gave on bogs. And so as bog, if anyone has a compost heap and you put it in your backyard and you put vegetable matter in there, it shuts down in winter. And then as you go into the spring and in the summer, the bacterial activity gets going again. If it's wet, it produces methane. There's no oxygen involved. If it's not wet, then there's a different kind of bacterial action, and the decay occurs much faster, and it produces carbon dioxide. And so these are the two main sets of feedbacks that we think are occurring, the outgassing from the ocean and the changes in the soil carbons. And so one of the prospects for the future is that as things warm up and we start to melt permafrost and invigorate some of the carbon decay, especially in middle and northern latitudes, and these processes are not included in the models, by the way, at the moment, then there is likely a further positive feedback. And so that will actually amplify the climate change by a small amount.
But I mean, that could be adding to the 100%, couldn't it, right now?
Yes, it could be that. I mean, suppose we are successful in decreasing our own emissions. It's quite plausible that Arctic temperatures will have risen enough, say, in the next decade and beyond, that a lot of CO2 and methane is coming out of what is now permafrost. In a sense, you know, climate has taken that frozen organic material out of the freezer, and a lot of it will go up as methane and CO2 in the atmosphere. So natural sources could increase greatly, totally out of our control. And this is also one of the essential difficulties of predicting climate change, is these what we call feedbacks that we cannot really quantitatively predict very well. And the climate response of the whole climate system is very sensitive to these feedbacks. So here, to me, this is one of our big problems. I mean, we cannot put a good number on what I would call catastrophic climate change, which we could possibly trigger. Are the chances of that happening negligibly small? I don't think so.
Dan Satterfield, CBS affiliate in Huntsville, Alabama. It might be informative to the group for maybe like a 90-second or two-minute discussion on the main GCMs that are in use and also their state of development. And by that, I mean, I know they go through cycles of use and then redevelopment and then back into use again. And so if someone could do that, it might be informative.
Can you do it in 90 seconds or 2 minutes?
Well, we're looking forward to in 5 or 10 years.
Well, I think there's something of the order of like 15 sort of major models that were used in the IPCC. And you're seeing a whole improvement of all aspects of the climate models taking place. For example, we're included now on the soil properties going down to several hundred meters. And we're looking at the details, for example, of the permafrost, because that's a very big uncertainty in our modeling. We include roughly something like 50 different species of plants. We're including in the oceans now many of the biological aspects of the oceans, and we're improving our ocean models in a very substantial way. So almost all aspects of the climate models, about every 5 years, gets upgraded based upon improved knowledge. And we're also, if I can just add this thing, we're seeing our models being put on very massively parallel computers. In fact, I'll be leading a conference in November where we'll be looking at computers that will be in the peta and exa scale range. In other words, something of the order of maybe a million processors all tied together to help us simulate on the climate system in more detail. So progress is being made.
Let me just add to Warren's comment that there are major groups in NASA, NOAA, and at NCAR. At NCAR, we have the Community Climate System Model, and 2 weeks ago there was a major workshop, as an annual workshop, of all of the users, which includes all of the universities. And so it's truly a community model in the terms of the development, and there were over 300 people at that meeting. And so there's a lot of people engaged in the development, and as you say, there is an intense cycle of development that and try to freeze the next version of the model for the next series of IPCC runs.
All right, we have lots of questions. We have about 15 minutes left, so let's keep it moving, and we'll try and get as many in as we can.
Paul, am I allowed to ask two, or am I limited to one?
Well, let's try one right now, because you got four people behind you, or three people behind you.
they're both very different. So. All right, well, we'll do the first one, and I don't mean this to be a provocative question at all. I'm just trying to get a better understanding myself. There was a documentary done in the last year, I guess, over in the UK called The Great Global Warming Swindle, which some of you may be familiar with. And there were scientists interviewed from the United States and Canada and the UK. And one of the things that they noted in the paleo record was that every time the temperature went up, the CO2 increased after that, as opposed to before it. And so they then make this unequivocal comment that, well, CO2 never drove the climate before, so what makes this any different?
What makes a difference is that the humans are now changing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And as you say, in the past it was a feedback or a response, and now humans are changing the composition of the atmosphere.
That was quick. Go ahead and ask your second one. I was anticipating a longer answer.
In the past, largely, what you call the solar forcing variations were predominantly orbital variations, and they were the real trigger, but CO2 was the feedback and it increased, right. And that shouldn't give us comfort, because it suggests that the response of the system to an initial warming is to produce a positive CO2 feedback. We know we have a positive water vapor feedback, as Kevin said. It's gotten moisture, and that's a really crucial feedback, and it not only produces further warming, but as Kevin and really as the projection suggests, the potential for heavier precipitation events in the future. So, again, it's perfectly understood and accepted.
Okay. The other thing, real quick, and this is loaded, and I don't want to take time away from the people behind me, but how frustrating is it to you as a group of scientists who have worked really hard on this issue that a lot of people are getting their information on both sides of the argument, if you will, from political sources that are very, very ardent about their... And just as an example, I mean, I bought a Prius a few months ago. The main purpose was to save money, okay? It didn't take 2 weeks for one of my friends to tell me, "You're not going left on me, are you?" You know? And seriously, it's like everybody's opinion seems to, you know, be assumed to have a political root or a political base to it. And, you know, Al Gore's movie was, I found it to be somewhat informative, but I still don't know what hanging chads have to do with climate change. Is that how do we get this back to a scientific debate and try to get the politics out of it as much as we can?
Jim wants to chip in.
Yeah, I'm going to try to take part of this and then tell you a little story that so you can go home with something new. The problem isn't the politicals. That's all about making money. Okay, you know, I mean, my governor is, you know, big on doing things, but it's all about making money. And all the NGOs and things, it's all about making money on the political side. The real problem I see with the confusion is the press and the the fact that we're doing a lousy job in university of, they don't know any science, okay? I'll give you the big example, then I'm going to tell you my little story. 2 years ago or so, one of these gentlemen probably remember when the English measured the water, how much water is going north at 27 degrees north in the Atlantic, okay? It's kind of a measurement made. It's a very bad, very poorly made measurement. It has big error bars, and they published a nice little paper in Nature. It said nothing about changes of the Gulf Stream, okay? And it showed that their estimate of the amount of water going north was decreased by a third from what was common, what you could read in a textbook before, okay? So before I could even read the paper, I get a call from a reporter from the Washington Post. It says, what about this theory that the Gulf Stream can stop? Now, I mean, I'm reading in lots of the stuff, you know, the Gulf Stream's going to stop. It ain't going to stop. Dr. Wunsch, who's one of the most highly respected scientists on the planet, is a member of the Academy and everything else, he said there's only two things have to happen for the Gulf Stream to stop, okay? The wind has to stop blowing, and the Earth has to stop rotating, okay? Okay, so let's not worry about the Gulf Stream stopping, because if the Earth stops rotating, we have nothing to worry about, okay? All right, now... Okay, so it's the press. Okay, now the reporter says to me when I said, "Oh yeah, and there's some kind of theories I don't believe, but there's theories out there that says, you know, North Atlantic circulation could change due to the change in the climate, and it'll take 50,000 years." She says, "What do you mean 50,000 years? It went down a third in 7 years. That means in 20 years there's no Gulf Stream." Okay, I mean that's the kind of science you get, and it's a real and over and over again, it's very difficult with reporters. But look, let's go home with a new story, okay? This is about natural climate change in our country, in the east part of our country. Apparently, although we don't have the observations, when our country was first formed, it must have been a hell of a lot warmer, okay? Because before 1835, the place that grew oranges for profit was the coastal counties in South Carolina and Georgia. Then in 1835, they had very bad freezes. It takes about 20 years to get back, right? And so they moved further south. So in the rest of the 1800s, the place to grow oranges was Savannah, Georgia, Jacksonville, and St. Augustine, okay? And I'm so happy to be with an American audience that understands some geography. Most my kids don't understand, right? Okay, so then in the 1800s, they had a couple bad freezes, had to move further south. Okay, sort of down about Gainesville, Alachua County. They're sort of not in the panhandle. But let me regress a little bit, okay? Before 1885 or so, I might be off by a couple years, where I live, everybody had orange trees. In South Alabama, everybody had orange trees, okay? There's a couple varieties that grow there now. This is natural climate change, okay? Now in the, you know, as soon as the federal government decided that forecasters could no longer give freeze forecasts because the private industry should do it in Florida, then we had another big freeze and they had to move further south. Now they're down by Lake Okeechobee, and they got two big problems. The biggest problem is hurricanes, knocks down the trees, right? And the second problem is the damn land is worth more for a new city for all those octogenarians moving to Florida than the other people. So this is natural climate change, okay? So I predict, because the land is more valuable, that your grandchildren will get their Florida oranges from Brazil, okay? Now, there will still be varieties, specialized things, but this is natural climate change. And so I would like these climate scientists to go back in their models and say, you know, what was the change? What was it like in 1800? You know, when our Constitution was written, it must have been a hell of a lot nicer and warmer, and we were happy. Okay? And please take that home. That's all true, and there's books that written about it and so forth. Thank you.
How old were you then, Jim?
You can do the sums. I'm 72 now.
By the way, ignore this. We have 10 minutes, and we're going to try and get in as many of these as we can. So if everybody could just try to be brief, we'll try and get them all in.
Yeah, I'll be quick. My name is Gene Norman. I'm from KHOU in Houston. A quick comment. I appreciate the tour yesterday. However, I didn't quite appreciate Rick Anthony's scolding of us. I took it as an insult at first, but I also took it as a challenge to be more educated about what's going on. I also appreciated seeing the climate models show what has happened as opposed to what is going to happen. So I like that verification. And I think more of that kind of communication needs to happen from your community to our community. That's my comment. My question is, we as broadcasters are faced with the challenge of trying to address the public who is trying to wrap their head around what you guys say. When you say unequivocal and you say human, it's our fault, then the response is, well, either I don't believe that or prove it to me. And I live in a place where we haven't had hurricanes for a while. So the perception of the audience is that, well, this is all nonsense, because if it was truly happening, then we would have proof. So I'd like you to help us, or give me a suggestion, or explain that a little bit so that I can help my viewers understand that. Thank you.
Do you want hurricanes? By the way, in Florida, we want tropical storms. My Floridians get really upset with this. We really want the tropical storms, because in the central Florida, it's like 30% of our rainfall, okay? Mm-hmm. We get the winter rain, which is important. The summer rain is, without tropical, it's very, very important for our economy. We don't want the big, heavy, you know, the bad storms, but tropical storms. One of the reasons that Georgians have had a big drought in central Georgia is because we had 2 years with no... See, Georgia doesn't really get the hurricanes, but they get the leftovers, okay? And the leftovers are very important for Alabama and Georgia.
I want to comment also, just because you didn't get hurricanes, or even if the U.S. doesn't get hurricanes, you know, there were two Category 5 storms that went into Mexico last year.
I'm quick to point that to people, but I'm just saying that the public perception isn't quite there yet.
Yeah, well... You know, going back to actually to the previous question, this relates to the science. You know, there's a lot of, you know, the difference between opinion and science is that we're dealing with facts, and in particular observational facts. They may have some uncertainties, and we want to lay those facts out as best we can, and all of the science and the reasoning and the physical components that go along with that as best we can, and then decide what we're going to do about it. And that's the approach we try to take in the IPCC. There's a lot of place for value systems that come in and decide what you're going to do about that, but there's a place for it.
Yeah, if I could just maybe add, I mean, this gets back to my opening comments where I mentioned that there's global change and then there's the regional implications and the local, right where you live. And the question that you pose is one that is, in fact, very often asked. I mean, I don't see it right where I am, so it must not be happening. So I think your ability to convey that there is still more variability, as Jim, who I have the wonderful respect for, has really been pointing out today, some of the regional variations that one sees in climate, that the natural variability on shorter timescales, that weather happens. And it can be largely independent, as Kevin says, in a subtle way, not now entirely independent of the change problem, but not dominated on a day-to-day basis by anthropogenic climate change. And again, the other distinction to keep in mind is the one between detection of the change and the attribution, where we back off a little and we say it's very likely that most of the observed warming is a result of the anthropogenic. So, I mean, there's a couple of qualifiers on that, both on the probability and that most other things are happening, natural variations are happening in the system, and we should all, and your ability to convey that can be very helpful.
All right, we have about 8 minutes left, so Bob?
Bob Ryan, in, NBC in Washington. Before I stumbled into broadcasting, I was did cloud physics for a while, and that seems to me, you know, we deal and we forecast sunshine and clouds each and every day. And we only recently began to understand a global climate atlas to understand the distribution of cloud. How, going forward with these models, do we have confidence that we're able to incorporate the clouds and their radiative properties within the global circulation accurately enough to have confidence? I mean, we talk about all of the gases, but the clouds seem to me to be one of the loose cannons that we don't know. If indeed, as Kevin points out, you know, we're getting ever more moist atmospheres, doesn't that mean ever greater convective systems, which will be injecting more moisture into the stratosphere? And what about global dimming being an increased a feedback, which will be not a positive, but could be a balancing feedback? And going forward, what's our understanding of clouds in this overall climate system?
Boy, that's a big question. Yeah. You could go on for quite a long time. We haven't got much time, so let me just make a couple of comments. Clouds are one of the weakest points of climate modeling in terms of our understanding. There is a new satellite up there called CloudSat that is about to produce a whole lot of new observations about especially the vertical structure of clouds, and with new results about actually how much it's raining around the world as a consequence of better sensing and different kind of sensing of clouds. And so observations are one way in which we can advance that particular science, and I expect to see some big advances occurring in the future, but indeed, that's one of the things which models don't do very well. For the planet as a whole right now, clouds are estimated to produce a slight cooling, but they have both a blocking of the sun effect or reflection of the sun effect, and they have a greenhouse effect, and they tend to cancel to a very large degree. And so it depends upon the height of the clouds as well as the extent of the clouds. And in general, the climate models show a slight positive feedback. In other words, as the hydrological cycle gets more intense and goes into the future, there's more intense updrafts but bigger downdrafts, and so you actually decrease the amount of clouds very slightly. And whether that's going to really happen or not is one of the big questions before us. And so it's an important question.
Yeah, I wonder if I can just add one more thing to that, and that is the role of aerosols interacting with the clouds. And we're just exploring that. And I think that we can improve our models as long as we have good data to put into our models. And so we need to understand the various processes. And I would sort of agree with the questioner. It is an area of high uncertainty. And thank you, Bob, for actually bringing up that question.
Yeah, no, that's one of the greatest uncertainties. One of the other things you asked about global dimming, and Peter had earlier raised the role of aerosols as a cooling effect, and this is one of the challenges we have in the future. Right now, some regions that are not showing warming are not showing that warming because they're aerosol polluted. And so as we begin, we hope, we would like to clear up the air, clear up the dimming, but that might lead to accelerated rates of warming. So
let me just say that global dimming is not global.
It's mostly urban. It's mostly focused in places where we're making observations, but not over the oceans. And so it's a bit of a misnomer. It also seems to have reversed in recent times. Across the United States, so especially east of the Rockies, there has been an increase in cloud in the last 30 years compared with prior to that. And so daytime temperatures have not gone up as much as models would have expected. There's a potential for a bigger warming in the United States than just about anywhere else in the world because of the changes in atmospheric circulation and the changes in cloudiness and the increases in rainfall that have occurred in the last 30 years compared with prior to that.
Somebody needs to buy Mike Elger a drink. He's given us an extra 5 minutes so we can get in his last two. These will be the last two questions. Fire away.
My name's Matt Miller from Topeka, Kansas. My question is centered around basically the global climate modeling. And I know we've had some questions already raised on the cloud physics side, the resolution at the synoptic scale level, but it seems like everything that we hear on global climate change is very highly centered around temperature trends. And so if we look at the temperature trends that are being projected by these global climate models, I'm curious because what I see is the output that I've been able to obtain, and maybe there's more accurate, and this is really where the question comes in. And if it's not as smooth of an output as it appears to be on a lot of the charts that we'll see in different reports, were there any of these models that have been able to resolve the last 12 to 18 months of cooling? And we've mentioned that there's that variability. Are the models able to pick up on that variability? Have they done a good job of that? I know we've been able to mimic the past, but are we able to mimic these short-term changes and fluctuations that we see, or are we just seeing the output as more of the trend output rather than these variances within that trend?
Well, the last year maybe has been dominated by a major La Nina in the tropical Pacific Ocean. In El Nino events, there's a buildup of heat, tail end of the El Nino, that heat gets moved across the ocean. It produces a warming in the ocean, gets moved to higher latitudes, and it gets moved into the atmosphere. And so the warmest year on record is 1998 by at least a number of the estimates, and that was because of the great big El Nino that occurred then. The opposite is happening now with the La Nina. It's a natural variability in the tropical Pacific. It's a temporary cooling, but it does relate to a redistribution of heat in the atmosphere, in the ocean, and it does not therefore necessarily reflect on the overall trends of global warming. There are places this past winter, though, in Northern Europe and Asia, where it was actually quite warm, much above normal. And that related actually to a positive North Atlantic oscillation pattern that had very little to do with that but a lot of the patterns around the world this past winter have been classic La Nina in many respects.
You want to make one comment? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, last year I think was the warmest on record on the continents, but only the seventh warmest. And for the reason that Kevin said, I mean, natural variations do happen. They will give regional variability from year to year. But think of it more of as a pause.
Okay. Go ahead.
Ty Shesky, KOB in Albuquerque. I heard a few moments ago somebody talked about how the warming climate would warm the oceans, and that would affect the ocean's ability to absorb or release carbon dioxide. One thing that we looked at yesterday a lot of was, you know, the summertime ice disappearing over the Arctic. I was just wondering, with a warmer climate, what kind of feedback that might have with, you know, the increased amount of open water during a bigger period of the year.
I think that's a very big feedback. I would almost put the feedback from melting ice, especially sea ice, second to water vapor in terms of the climate system. And sort of what's happening there in the Arctic is that the thickness of the ice has gone down year after year in a pretty much a steady, a sort of steady way. And also, when you have on the thin ice, on the wind can affect it very effectively and move that ice and actually clear large areas, and you essentially change from a white surface to a very dark surface of the ocean surface, and you get this very strong ice albedo feedback. So at least I think that it's going to be hard for thick ice to ever form again. Now that we've gone into a warming sort of situation, and that we can expect that the Arctic region is going to warm up substantially over this next few years into the next few sort of decades. The only thing that would cool it off now, in my opinion, is probably a very strong volcanic eruption. you can hope, but just keep in mind that a volcanic eruption only impacts the climate for maybe up to 18 months or up to 2 years or so. So that we're going to still sort of see on this gradual warming trend.
Jim, you wanted to?
Yeah, I'll just say that, I agree with Warren's conclusions and speculation and understanding thing. But there was one thing I don't want you to go away with incorrect scientific thing, and that is that when the ocean warms, it doesn't necessarily release CO2. The big example is El Nino, a huge region of the subtropical Pacific or on the equator. Warms up significantly when we have El Nino, and in fact, it decreases CO2 output tremendously. And you can actually see this in the very good record Peter Tantz talked about from Mauna Loa and the CO2 record. And I've been there during La Nina, and when you're in the ocean of La Nina, you have upwelling of very cold water that's below the euphotic zone, and that water comes up to the surface. It's very cold, and it outgasses. It outgasses CO2. You can just see the bubbles of CO2 coming out of the water. And you can also see that increase in CO2 with a big La Nina occur also. So in general, I agree that at middle latitudes, warming tends to, there's other regions. For example, you live on the West Coast. The coastal upwelling regions you have in the summer, all along where you have the real cold water on your beach. People don't realize in Oregon, the beach temperatures are warmer in January than they are in July. So you have all this upwelling. The upwelling brings up cold water, and it outgasses lots and lots of CO2. So it all depends on where you are in the ocean. So it's true, but it's not true.
Like to add something to that.
It's true, but it's not. In other words, I'm an oceanographer. I've been to sea. I've seen these things, okay? And it may in the central, if you go, for example, in the central Atlantic or the central Pacific where you have the big gyres and it's relatively warm, okay? There's no upwelling, and the surface layers don't have the CO2 in them to outgas. They've already outgassed it. If they get a little bit warmer, they ain't going to outgas anymore. They don't have any. You have to have, in the ocean, you have to bring the water up from below the euphotic zone to bring up the CO2. Then if you warm it up, you outgas like crazy. So shifts, for example, in the Antarctic Circumpolar Current and other things can cause huge outgassing of CO2.
Yeah.
And that's the way the ocean works.
Okay, briefly, because we have to wrap this up.
It's not entirely correct.
You're not an oceanographer, though.
No.
Have you ever been to the ocean?
No.
I've been to the ocean.
Why is the water outgassing that comes from greater depth? It's because there is what used to be organic carbon, what used to be fixed by photosynthesis sometime in the past, and has decayed while it was below the surface, that increases the CO2. That water is cold and comes up and has high CO2, and that will outgas. But it also has high nutrients in them. Right. And biological organisms will have a feast with that.
Right.
And photosynthesize that, and then so you add this water outgasses first, and as it warms and the biology works, it becomes undersaturated and takes it up again. So the net effect is pretty much zero, actually. What really matters is, what is the biology doing?
Maybe if I could just add to that real quickly with...
Ask me real quick.
Real quick.
Yeah.
El Nino does more than affect the oceans as well. It affects precipitation, say, over North America. Typically, in El Nino events, it's wetter. And La Nina, it's drier. And that affects the rate at which plants grow, and that affects the uptake. And in the marvelous time series that Peter's group produces, the Mauna Loa time series, you'll see this seasonal cycle, which... goes down in the northern hemisphere warm season as plants in association with the vegetative cycle through the annual cycle. So you'll see it go up and down and up and down. And so that's another factor that comes into play in this complex carbon cycle that works.
If you have not done so, you really should spend some time on the IPCC website and look at the reports, because the IPCC looked at a lot of the arguments and addressed those issues. And just to get, and you get a lot of good talking points, which a lot of us are asking for. Just by way of one very brief example, a concern I had was urbanization. The expanding heat island in cities, was that skewing the temperature record? They looked at that, and if you average that globally, it's only 0.06 degrees Celsius average globally, and that's a very negligible impact. So those are the types of things you can find, you know, on that IPCC website, and I really urge you. It's www.ipcc.ch, I believe. Is that right? And, I mean, it really is a wealth of information, and you can take a lot from that. All right, we have just spent 90 minutes with a very eminent panel of climate scientists. This is some of the best education we've had. Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much.